This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you by the contest that we're running for a chance to win Psi Rollers. That's the newest trick by Michael Breger. We started the contest last week, and I encourage you to go to the website here this week at themagicwordpodcast.com, and there you'll find a form you can complete and enter. So far, we haven't had that many people enter because we were kind of late in posting this, and we kind of buried it a little bit in last week's episode that was a report on the fourth and final day of the 4F convention. And so if you had not listened to that, perhaps you weren't aware of that. So I want to put that straight up front here to make sure that you are aware of it and go and enter. One entry per person. That's not one entry per email, but one entry per person, please. This is also available to anybody really in the world. However, if you are a winner whose name is randomly selected in the U.S., domestic postage will be paid by Michael Breger. Thank you very much, who happens to be a friend of the Magic Word. We thank him very much for his patronage. And also, if you are from overseas, you and your name happens to be drawn, then we will notify you as to how much that postage will be, and you'll be responsible then for reimbursing Michael for the foreign postage. If you're not interested in doing that, then just don't enter the contest if you are outside the domestic U.S. So this week we're going to be talking with Nathan Fan. I happened to be in Houston before I headed out on my trip out of the country to France, and I saw his evening show, and it was a lot of fun, and it was high energy, and he sings and does everything, golly. And I've seen him many times in the past. We've had a chance to sit down and chat just for some brief moments here and there, but I have always wanted to take some time to actually do a full episode, and so we were not going to be bothered. We actually were in a bar, and we stepped outside with our scotches, and we sat inside my parked car in the parking lot and recorded this conversation. So that's why it sounds like it does, which I think it sounds kind of like a studio. I think it sounds great. Anyhow, I know you're going to be enjoying this one because a lot of the things that we talk about will have to do with anything that you're performing. If you have an act at all, this is something that will help to brush up your act because he has a lot of suggestions on how to work with an audience, how to select volunteers. He has some great stories from working on television because he's been on America's Got Talent and on Penn and Teller Foolish. He's been a regular on Masters of Illusion, and he is someone that we should pay attention to, and I recommend that you do as well. So I'm going to step out of the way and introduce our guest here this week. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Nathan Fan, here on The Magic Word. Today, we're going to actually spend a little bit more time with someone that I have chatted with in the past. You may have heard him perhaps at a convention or two whenever he's been performing someplace, or that perhaps whenever I was working with the Masters of Illusion a couple of years ago, he was one of the performers there. But you perhaps have seen him on a lot of different shows, including Masters of Illusion, of course. But Penn and Teller Foolish, mm-hmm. And he'll tell you about all the rest of them.
Wizard Wars.
Yeah. Keep going. What else?
Or America's Got Talent, Hollywood Christmas Parade, Don't Blink. Oh, boy, if you happen
Those
to watch...
Just a few. So this is a guy that, again, you would have seen around someplace. If not, then I recommend that you could go to the MagicWordPodcast.com blog, and there you will see a couple of videos. I'm going to post some of his YouTube videos that you can see him performing in as well. But he is a very interesting gentleman, actually Vietnamese, but was brought up then in Glasgow, which is why that he has such a wonderful accent, I think, and you can understand him, too.
Yeah, I have to intentionally kind of bring the accent back down a bit, especially after I'm drinking a lovely scotch with you.
Having a little Balvenie right now.
Yeah, a wee bit of Balvenie.
A little 12-year-old. So mm-hmm. Please welcome my friend. Here he is, Nathan Fan. Hey there, Nathan. Let me clink glasses
Scott,
over here.
Yes, then. Cheers. Okay.
Same to you then, my friend. So glad that we finally get a chance to chat over here. This has been it's been lovely. So we actually just finished watching your show, and you were performing with Hayden Alcorn, and the two of you seem to have a nice chemistry together. You said you've been friends for like 10 years both live in Southern California. How did that relationship begin?
So neither of us can actually remember the first time we met. It was either at a masterclass I gave at my alma mater, Orange County School of the Arts, where I was a part of the Creative Writing Conservatory, and they asked me to come back and talk about writing and how it applies in a performance, practical performance situations. Or if it was when he was a stage manager for a magic variety show I performed at. So it's one of the two, and we can't remember which one came first. But basically, I think it was when he was stage manager, and we just hit off, cause he told me that he does some magic as well. And then we just kind of started chatting a bit since then. And he's decently younger than me. I think he's, 8 years younger than me, something like that.
Okay.
And so as I was like, you know, coming up through the ranks, you know, from the kids' birthday parties through the television series, he was a friend of mine, and I would, because I knew he was comfortable in a magic setting as well as working backstage, I would frequently call upon him to come and be my stage manager or my opening act, because I knew if something went wrong, he could jump on stage and do 5 minutes while I went and sorted exactly like, yeah, then, you know, something was happening.
Right.
And so it did, and that did happen once or twice, actually. So he's, and then he saw, so because he started coming with me to gigs, he started seeing what it was like to perform in the magic world, to headline venues. And then he started making his own way, and he was one of the, I think the resident character magician at Knott's Berry Farm for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
There's this thing they do every summer called Ghost Town Alive. And what he does is he will come up with a character, and he'll come up with something that works in terms of magic show. So for a while he was doing like this medicine show. So it was like, hi, and he was like a snake oil salesman, but he would write this script so that it worked as a magic show. So he would do multiplying bottles, but because he was selling this tonic.
Ah, that makes sense.
You know, that sort of thing. Yeah. So he has, you know, this bombastic personality, but he also grew up doing musical theater and Shakespeare and stuff. So we just kind of click on a lot of regards. And and then this tour that we're doing now, originally I was meant to perform in Pittsburgh with a different magician friend. And then that fell through. So I immediately thought about Hayden and rang him up. And we just finished driving 2 straight days. I think we literally drove for 24 hours in the last 2 days.
To get from
Southern California, right by Disneyland, to Las Cruces, New Mexico, New Mexico to Houston.
Wow. And then from here, you go to Nashville, and then...
Nashville, and then to just south of Dayton, Ohio. And then from there, we go out to Pittsburgh. We're playing at Liberty Magic for 6 weeks with a great show that we've been talking about for like 6 years called History of Magic Part 1, very loosely inspired by the Mel Brooks film, History of the World Part 1, which is all going to be like every piece is like anchored in a part of history, whether it's magic history or human history, and we show the way that magic played into that part of history. So like, for instance, one of the first sketches we have is the invention of the first magic trick, where we are in ancient Egypt in like 25
Now, is it cups and balls or is this rings?
It's cups and balls.
Okay.
It's cups and balls. And so he's like, magic trick, step right up and see a magic trick. And I'm like, I'm sorry, a what? And then, you know, he does cups and balls. And then we have another routine where like, oh, we talk about the role magicians played, quote unquote, in the 1920s during Prohibition, rum running, hiding alcohol by magically turning it into other substances. Yeah. So it's a great excuse for what I call mini bar, which is basically hospitality, but done in a different size.
Yeah.
So we have all this stuff throughout the history of humanity and magic. And it's I'm very, very excited for it. So that's the big gig that brought us out. But and along the way, I was like, listen, we can fly and bring half the stuff we want to bring, or we can drive.
Yeah. And bring everything.
Everything. And maybe pick up a little work on the way and have some laughs.
Have some fun. Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of places along the way. I mean, you were talking about Nashville. You're going to be at the House of Cards?
House of Cards. We're going to go visit House of Cards. We asked Joey, but Joey's a busy man.
Yeah.
So he didn't have a chance to throw us in the schedule, but we're going to at least visit and say hi. So we're it's this fine line of like, sometimes you want to hit magic venues and sometimes you want to bring magic to people who don't get to see it.
Chicago's got the Rhapsody Theater then also.
Yes, as well.
You know,
Ricardo's
place.
We want to do that at some point, but it was, we were like, okay, if we hit Chicago though, it takes out this place that maybe we might hit.
Gotcha.
If we did Chicago, we probably wouldn't have been able to do Houston. We would have had to like start heading north earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That makes some sense.
And then on the way back, we're going to hit St. Louis, where my buddy Lucas Brenneman lives. He's the one who invented the Dark Side deck. And so he's out there. And then we're going to hit Denver. And then we're going to hit Las Vegas. And then we're going to hit like Thousand Oaks, California.
But while you're in Denver, you ought to drive down to Colorado Springs to see Cosmo Solano. He's got a show there. And then, of course, Castle Rock is where Joe and Carol Massey.
Excellent. Okay.
Great little theater they've got there then, too.
Only spot I've ever been to close to Denver is up at the Stanley Hotel. Have you been up there yet?
I have not, but I'm familiar with that. And Aidan Sinclair.
Yeah, Aidan Sinclair. Mm-hmm. So if you've not been yet, so if you've ever seen The Shining.
Yes.
The Shining is based off of the Stanley Hotel.
Correct.
And in fact, the 90s miniseries was actually shot at the Stanley Hotel. And so Aidan Sinclair does this beautiful, and he changes it like once every year, year and a half, show where, and it is prime example of the power of storytelling with bizarre magic and mentalism and magic.
Aidan has quite an interesting story. Podcast with him over Halloween several years ago, and some of the things he was telling me about in his life, I mean, he doesn't pull any punches about serving time in prison and the kinds of magic he did for some of the other prisoners that almost he thought was going to cost him his life. I mean, there's some interesting stories that we're going back and listen to that episode. But I know some other people who have worked over there and filled in for him from time to time.
Yep. Because he's got the underground, and now he's got Hannibal doing the 13 seance
as well. That's right, Hannibal's working
with him then, Hannibal's up there. So if you're ever in the area, it's like about an hour outside of Denver, I think. It's up in
the mountains in near Aspen.
Estes Park. Yeah. Estes Park. It is 7,000 feet above sea level, so get ready for a little bit of a change in the air. You definitely can't drink as much up there, as I found out the hard way. It's also tough to perform as energetically as I do up there.
Well, you know, you can get just as drunk on water as you can on land.
this is true. That's one of the great things about cruise ships. I can drink forever.
Well, and so that you are doing a lot of cruise ships, and that's what I was going to ask you when you were talking about doing this tour and extended and things you were doing, and we were talking earlier when we were at the theater about the different cruises that you were on when you're out for several months at a time. So do you have any contracts that are coming up later this year?
So many.
Or have you had to turn some down because of this? Or?
I did have to turn one down because I had the 6 weeks out in Pittsburgh that I blocked off, but I forgot that I was going to spend a week driving out and a week driving back.
Right.
And they're like, oh, they want you for this. I'm like, oh, no, I need time because I have to like prep for this before I head out. And they understood. So I do a lot of work with Princess. If you want to see my exact lineup, you can go to my website. Am I allowed to say my website?
Absolutely.
Just checking. You know, sometimes you're like, no, don't talk about it.
Magic. Asian Man.
Exactly. .com. Go to magicasianman.com. There's a little tab that says upcoming. I post all my TV appearances. I post all the cruise ships. All the land gigs are all there. It's a lot of Princess right now. Princess really, really likes me. And you know, because they're smart. I actually gave up my apartment. I'm officially homeless now because between now, when we're filming this in what, end of March through mid September, I will spend a total of about 4 or 5 nights back in California.
I've often wondered about that. Why that people who are full-time cruise guys, I mean, I know for a long time, Fred Becker was doing that as well as Chip Romero and others. Like, why do you have a house or an apartment or anything? I mean, you could save so much money by not having anything because you're living at sea.
I think it's a combination of factors. I think that for some people, they bought the house before work happened.
Okay.
And then I think for other people, there is something really nice about having a home base, some place to come back to.
Too. Because you got your stuff, you're comfortable there.
Yes. There are like, especially if you like creature comforts. Like for me, I love being able to come home where like I know I have my 65-inch 4K TV with high-speed internet and a kitchen where I can cook my own food, all these things, all my stash of, I have thousands of dollars worth of alcohol, you know.
Gabe Blackstone told me that on the Masters of Illusion tour that you're the favorite bartender.
I am the, bartender. she tells a great story that is true about how one time she was having particular difficulty with a specific venue. And because I'm the quote-unquote comedy magician, right? And the comedy magician track in Masters of Illusion has much less stuff. I mean, comedy magicians in general, less stuff.
Yeah.
And so I was the first one to pack up and be done and back on the cruise, back on the tour bus. Mm-hmm. And so I would also bring alcohol and mixers and bitters. And so I was the tour bartender. So once I was back on the bus, I would send out a message to everyone and say, all right, Bar Nathan is open, place your orders. And then that way your drink was waiting for you when you got onto the tour bus.
On the bus,
so
right.
In this particular instance, Gay was having a rough time with one of the venues. There's a miscommunication about X, Y, or Z. And she's like, I think it might be two. And I actually rang her up and we had to speak in code because she was in front of the client. He's like, I was like, would you like a lemon drop? Or it's like, yes, you know what? That actually sounds good. Yeah, we'll talk about this later. She sounded very professional because she was in front of the client. But yeah, so I'm the unofficial tour bartender whenever I'm on tour with Masters of Illusion. Yeah, I just, you know, I love classic cocktails.
Has there been something that you have invented, like of your own?
Oh, yeah, actually. I invented a s'mores old fashioned.
Oh, gosh.
It's quite
lovely. A s'mores martini would sound good.
Yeah,
because they have espresso maybe or something.
Yeah, so they have, you know, they have like the chocolate liqueurs that you could do. So basically for a s'mores old fashioned, you want a fairly neutral bourbon. Because you want for this one, you want the other flavors to do the talking, right?
Okay.
So you do have to make a marshmallow syrup, which is basically where you have to take marshmallows. You are going to then toast them.
Melt them, basically.
Yeah, so you're going to toast them first, so you get a little bit. Yeah, make a mush, but you want to toast them first so you get a bit of that burnt flavor.
Oh, yes.
That smoky burnt flavor.
Of course you do.
And then you're going to throw that in with some water. And then you're going to cook it, and that's going to reduce down and become thick and syrupy. And you're going to throw a little bit of vanilla extract in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to let that cool, strain out any of the bits and flakes. You're going to use bourbon, chocolate bitters, this marshmallow syrup, and then you do just a tiny dusting of cinnamon on top because you have that cinnamon. And if you want, instead of using
graham
sugar,
cracker or whatever,
graham cracker, you can use honey.
Mm-hmm.
And then you use the cinnamon. So you have the honey and cinnamon from the graham cracker. You have the chocolate from the chocolate. You have the marshmallow, the vanilla. You have the bourbon. And then if you really want to go overboard, you take a wee marshmallow and you stick it on a skewer and you toast that sucker instead of having the cherry. That goes on top. So you immediately get welcomed by the fragrance of the cinnamon and the burnt marshmallow and you drink it and it's a lovely thing.
And the beauty of that. Wow. Well, there you go. So now you guys got to have a drink recipe then.
Yep. And if you have any questions about how to make it, just go to my website. You can hit me up.
Oh, you got that?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, is it on your website?
No, it's not on there, but you can go to my website and you can contact me through my website. There's a little tab that says Contact Nathan.
Yeah. Now, one of the things, boy, there's so much I want to talk to you about.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you had mentioned earlier about was a suggestion that was from Jeff McBride, as far as, you know, doing that Zed, where you're kind of looking at the back of the audience and kind of working your way forward. And I want to talk a little bit about that because Vito Lupo had some other ideas then as well. I want to chat about this. So go ahead and tell them what we're talking about.
So I don't remember if Jeff told me this directly or if I heard it secondhand. There's a lot of advice from Jeff that I actually got secondhand, but it doesn't mean it's not good.
Sure.
So for him, you know, making a connection to the audience is very important. It's important in magic and stand-up comedy and so many things. So he would say that you want to make a Z, sorry for the Americans, a Z.
Z
or a
like
Z. So like, for instance, as you start talking to the audience, stare all the way to the back and to the left for you. And as you're
stage
talking,
stage left.
Yes, stage left or house right. Yeah. And then as you're talking, your eyes cross across the back of the room all the way to stage right at the very back. And then as you continue talking, drag your eyes down into the left towards the front row diagonally to, the front seats in the
stage left,
and then drag them back across again.
The front row.
So you're creating a Z or a Z. And in that process, you will appear to have looked in basically everybody's direction. And so doing that helps a lot, because if you go out and you just perform straightforward, you're not alienating, but you aren't working hard to connect with two-thirds of the audience, essentially, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
And so he says do that. So I do employ a bit of that in my show. There's also certain beats in my show, which I block to cross all the way to stage left, throw this entire 2 minutes straight at this side of the audience.
Okay.
And then I do another 2 minutes all the way to the other side.
And you walk physically to the other
side
of the stage. And
I physically walk. Yeah, don't just look, like physically walk. I work up quite the sweat when I perform, and especially on cruise ships. You know, you got these 1,000-seat theaters and I am just booking it across the stage.
Well, sometimes you got balconies too.
And there's balconies as well sometimes. And then when you're touring across the nation, you will have these gorgeous like vaudeville houses that will have like opera seats, opera boxes, all along the side. So like, make an effort to look at people, or at least look in the direction, because even if you can't see them, doesn't mean, you know, they can't see you. So if you look at them and you act as if you can look directly into someone's eyes, they feel that connection. And it's The more and more venues that you will encounter, there's a lot of rock venues. Like there's one in Westbury, New York, which I think is like part of Long Island or something. And that is about a 2,000 seat venue that's in the round. And it's mostly rock stars and comedians, but Masters of Illusion passes through there. Harry Blackstone Jr. passed through there ages ago, which is where we got that connection. And so I perform magic shows in the round sometimes. Mm-hmm. And on a lot of these newer cruise ships, I think celebrity ships, and the brand new Sun Princess has what's called the arena. And that's about 1,000 seats where you're surrounded 270 degrees with the option for some of the stage to come out and more seats to come in wow. around you.
Wow.
And while magic is not always designed to play in the round,
right.
to have the ability to do some of it in the round, that is in and of itself a feat. A separate feat entirely is to connect with an audience in the round. And think about, I mean, you've got all these, was it the Globe, right? The Globe Theatre.
Globe was,
right? Mm-hmm. In the round. And, you know, if, boy, if the Shakespeare's drunk players could do it, so can you. So I think that connection to the audience is something we sometimes forget about because we're so focused on what we're doing. And there is a lot that we're doing. We're trying to be funny. We're watching the angles. We're trying to make sure the slight is playing correctly. We're trying to make sure that someone didn't catch us flashing. And once
all of your timing and your choreography, your blocking
still has to work, right? Mm-hmm. And you're not flashing. So on top of all that, if you can do all that, get comfortable enough with all that, that now you can start playing in the round so that you can deliver this line over here and then cross to your 3 o'clock and deliver a line over here across to your.
So five. One of the things that I was going to say, I think that Lito Lupo was the one that I had heard this from, and that is of to hold someone's attention. It might have been Jeff McBride, but I thought it was Lito. Basically, that you are looking, you like you said, you can't see because of the lights, and so you're looking out there and you finish a sentence. You don't have to finish the thought, but you finish the sentence and then you look to the other person. And then as you're looking to them, you finish that sentence with them and then you finish another sentence. In other words, that you're talking to someone, you finish the whole thought. So it looks like, you know, you're having a conversation with somebody rather than just scanning the whole audience, you know, the whole time.
Absolutely.
And,
yes.
And, oh, I remember this is another thing that actually this did come from Vito, and he was saying how that you would be talking to somebody over here and then you might move your head. Let's say I'm pointing to the stage right. So I'm pointing, you're looking at somebody over there and then you move your head to the left while your eyes are still looking at that person. And then now you're looking to someone over to stage left and you finish that conversation as your eyes and your head kind of moves down in that you can go to a Z, right. you know, type of thing as well. But the point is that everybody feels that you are talking with them directly.
Yes. I think that the Z is a really good starting point. And I think that it is a good, it's like an algorithm, how like it'll get you where you need to be. It may not be the most efficient way or the best way, but it guarantees a specific outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I also have a decent kind of upbringing in stand-up comedy. And stand-up comedy is
Did
one
you
of
start
those
with that?
Let's see what, I mean, stand-up comedy.
As far as your timing, I mean, you felt like you had.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I did a lot of stand-up comedy in high school and then some, in early college years as well. And, you know, never went huge with it, but I thought it was a very important thing to learn how to do because it's kind of, you know, at its purest sense, you know, it is to the entertainment world what like mentalism is to magic. It's like, it's just you and your words. And mentalism is like slimmed down. It's like, it's maybe papers and pencils, but the rest is just you and your audience and your words.
That's exactly right.
And so stand-up comedy is super important. I think I've said this before, I think years ago when we did
You can't hide behind your props.
You can't hide behind your props. And it's, I think everyone should take some improv, should do some basic theater,
Good
and
advice.
Some stand-up comedy. Because stand-up comedy needs to feel like a conversation. The next time you watch one of those Netflix specials, Comedy Central specials, whatever it is, notice how it feels like such a wonderful conversation. And
it
part
does.
Of that is...
And the flow, the timing. And all that.
And like Vito says, sometimes what you want to do is you're gonna say something and you're gonna kind of act like sometimes you will genuinely hear a very specific reaction from someone in the audience. Uh-huh. And whether or not you know that's coming, you can fake it or you can genuinely find like, oh, here's the person I'm gonna say this to today, because they laughed at this one specific thing or they gave a weird reaction.
Yeah.
So you can bring this over here and then you can act like someone else almost chimed in on top of that and you can look over here and say,
oh, you're agreeing with him or something.
Oh, okay, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Or, you know, sometimes you hear like a weird guffaw or a weird chortle, and sometimes it's just like a laugh in a place you've never heard it before, and you can use that to carry the momentum from like you're leaping from lily pad to lily pad to get across the river.
The only way that you could do that, though, Nathan, is by actually feeling comfortable enough with what you're doing. So number one, have everything down. So you're not worried about the one thing that was interesting, I thought, that you did not mention about all the different aspects of that are moving parts of your show, and that you did not mention the trick itself. I mean, about worrying, okay, did I, you talk about flashing or whatever, but it's like, oh, did I flip that switch, or did I turn on the Bluetooth remote? Those are things that you shouldn't have to worry about, because those are the methods of what you're doing should be so innate in your personality and your stage performance that you're not worried about that. You're thinking about what the person's saying, how to react to what they're saying, and you have to be in the moment. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. You have to be in the moment.
Absolutely. So in the acting world, because in addition to stand-up comedy, you know, I got into the acting world when I was in my teenage years, and I did a lot of stage plays, a lot of musicals, straight plays, Shakespeare, Chekhov. I've done a lot.
You did Chekhov. Wow.
Chekhov, yeah. I've done The Seagull. There are not many people that know what the Seagull is. But, you know, you have to get so familiar not only with the lines, but with the plot. So that if at some point one of your castmates goes up, which means to forget your lines, you can jump in and help finish telling the story. I was mentioning this to you earlier. I did interactive murder mystery dinner theater off and on for about 10 years. And when you're doing the same 3, 4, 5 shows for 10 years, you get very familiar with them, especially when you're playing multiple characters and you're playing it with different actors. So when that happens, you know every beat of that script. You know exactly where you're meant to wind up. So if somebody comes in and doesn't know
your part
line,
and the other parts.
Yeah, and so the instant you hear a pause that's longer than 2 seconds, or a pause that you can tell is not a pause of acting, but a pause of
forgetfulness.
Forgetfulness, or someone doesn't say their line. It's like, you can then jump and say, that look on your face, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking there's no way he would have taken this medication knowing it would have interacted with the alcohol like this.
Yeah.
And then the person goes, yes, that is what I was thinking. And that's a bit clunky, but you get what I'm saying.
I get the point. That's funny.
Yeah, same thing with a card trick. You know that at some point, this card has to wind up on top of the deck so you can Mercury fold.
Right.
Great. They have now grabbed the deck out of your hands with, you know, destroying your break, whatever it is, and they now have shuffled the card and said, now do the trick. So you either have done this enough times that you've already crimped the card, or you're like, okay, I'm now going to have to go through the deck and spot it, or maybe you've already prepped and you have a marked deck so you can look at it without even, you know, without even looking at the face of the cards, you can still spot their card.
That's why he's loved about Roger Clouse talking about half moves, where you're just doing a little bit now and then a little bit later. You have to do it all at one time.
I did one of those tonight in my show when I was doing the balloon thing.
I was thinking you're doing it when you had the confabulation.
Yeah, the balloon thing with the confabulation. Yeah. There's a moment where, okay, I do one movement to load. I recently started using this thing called Balloon Oracle, which is a magic wand that has a pin built into it. So you would like take the cap off of the one of the white ends.
I love that clever line. It's like, well, they took my scissors, so I got this. I never look at a magic wand.
Never take the magic wand. And it's great because it is you can use a confabulation, but it's mostly used for like a card in balloon type effect. So, you know, the old, for those who are not familiar with Balloon Oracle, it's an effect by Henry Harrius. And basically, you know, the whole thing where you would palm something where you're holding a balloon, when you pop it,
fall, that falls out
as if it's inside, and you would put a piece of balloon inside
so it looks like and feels like there's something shaking around inside the balloon.
So Henry Harrius and the other guy, I forget his name, who worked on this, basically give you this thing that looks like a folded playing card that goes inside the balloon, and they give you this magic wand where the end comes off and it's hollow with a little load chamber, and it also comes with this form that holds all 52 playing cards.
Wow.
So you can have someone do this, and as you reach inside, you just grab that one playing card, load it, put the cap on,
boom, you're done,
and you can now you're set. So for me, I'm using this as a confabulation, and instead of me having to load the thing and load the cap on in one movement, I go in and I just load the one thing, and I joke about throwing a pair of scissors at the balloon, and of course they freak out because, like, why would you throw a pair of scissors? I'm like, I'm just kidding, I can't do that, because they took my, and I tell a story about
makes sense,
security confiscating my scissors because they're too big. So you get to break up the movement into two beats. It's like, you know, if you're doing Mercury Cardfold, why not break that up into two beats so people don't see you holding the cards and moving them in a weird way. There are lots of things we could do where we can break it up into two beats, but that's only if the story and the momentum are strong enough to justify breaking this up. There's a lot about storytelling and comedy and monologues and improv, you know, because you start to learn.
And the timing, I guess,
the timing
you're talking about.
Timing is so important.
Yeah. And And then going on, talking about cruise ships then a little bit, we were discussing that briefly then as well, about where you're not necessarily going to be doing a lot because you got so much stuff. You're going to be out of town and everything. Do you enjoy doing, I think cruising is a little bit different now than when I was doing it, but do you enjoy that more than doing theater shows?
It's a different beast. Everything has its advantages and drawbacks, right? Everything.
Sure.
So one of the wonderful things about cruise ships, the audiences, if I had not done a 5 month in Vegas with Masters of Illusion, I would not be ready for cruise ships.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. 1,000%. Cruise ship audiences in some ways are easy because they have nothing else to do.
Right.
But in other ways, they didn't come on the cruise to see a magic show. Some of them, almost everyone appreciates a good singing show. Not everybody appreciates a good magic show.
But you sing also, which is another...
This is true. That does help a bit.
We haven't gotten into this part, but we'll talk about this later too.
Yes, put a pin in that. We'll come back to that. But, you know, not everyone even knows that they like magic because a lot of people have only seen rubbish magic. And so they are just there to be entertained, to pass the time. And it is great in so much of the fact that unlike four-walling a venue or playing in Vegas or Branson or Pigeon Forge, you are not paying for that space. You do not have to sell tickets to make your money. You just show up. They just send you the contract. You show up with your stuff. You tech it. You do the shows whenever they tell you to. Even if nobody shows up, you still
get it. It's just a job and you have no skin in the game, basically.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, it is lovely. And you get to do two different 45-minute shows. Mm-hmm. And most of the magic world now needs probably 20 minutes from you, whether it's House of Cards, Chicago Magic Lounge, Magic Castle. Most places only need about 20 minutes. Marvin's Magic Theater needs a full hour. Hour and five, 10 maybe, max. There are a few places that require more material. I think even maybe, what is it, Keller's in Erie, I think is about 20 minutes. So, you know, it's really great to be able to perform for a length of time where you get to establish a rapport with the audience. So in that regard, it's lovely and there's no skin in the game. However, they're not there to see you. And so sometimes they will show up 15 minutes late. I had a bunch of like a family of six people walk in, maybe 10 minutes before my show was over.
What did we miss?
Yeah, exactly. And now here is the thing. On the one hand, is it rude to show up late to a show? Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. On a cruise ship, it's their vacation.
That's true. You can't badmouth them.
Yeah, so when people show up late, just be glad they showed up at all. When they leave early, just be glad they showed up at all. Plus, some of them have wee bladders.
Good advice.
Some people, if they fall asleep in the audience, listen, we have 70-year-old people who've been walking around port all day, and then they show up on the ship, and they're drinking, and it's hot out, and now they're in a dark room, and the ship is lightly rocking.
Yeah. Yeah, what do you expect? The same thing like in movie theaters.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Whenever.
So, like, if they bought tickets to come and see you perform, that's slightly different. However, they also paid you money to come and see it.
That's
so
right.
They have some investment.
They feel like I'm going to stick around or stick
away.
So
it's a fine line of, like, their politeness is a thing, but also, on the other hand, it's their money. It depends on what you think you can kind of get out of maybe addressing it or not addressing it. Like, when someone's talking during your show, there are two schools of thought, right? Depending on what kind of talking that is. If it's early enough, if you keep on talking, keep on moving through the act, they will eventually realize, usually, oh, there's a show happening. I should shut up and pay attention.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you realize, oh, these people are not going to shut up. I need to address this. And you can't necessarily lay into them 1,000% because maybe there's an extenuating circumstance you don't know about.
Could be autistic.
I once had a gentleman who was on his mobile device and it was because it was translating for him and he was hard of hearing.
Interesting.
I once had a woman with binoculars in the second row. Turns out she had very bad vision. Mm-hmm. So I felt a little bit bad about calling her out for that. And so like you just learned that like 99 times out of 100, you're probably justified in laying into them and saying something clever and quippy. But there is the one odd time here and there where there's a very good reason for it. And so is it worth saying the line? Is any laugh worth alienating one audience member or a section of an
audience? Walter Blaney always said, when in doubt, leave it out.
Yeah. And I think that's safe. The more I perform, the more I've realized, like, oh boy, there are people who volunteer themselves.
So you don't
the way that
you don't handle hecklers like directly. I mean, unless they are really drunk or...
What I find works best is to let the audience handle the heckler.
That's a good point. That's exactly what I would do.
Because if you just... most of the time, if you just politely remind the heckler that they are in the minority, that you are one out of 1,000 people who wants to do what you're doing, you're prioritizing yourself above these other people, then they will usually shut up.
Or else the other audience around them say, hey, why don't you pipe down?
Yeah. There are occasionally times where I do have to kindly remind the audience. This happened to me actually just about a couple months ago on a cruise ship where people were getting very, very loud and talking all the way in the back. And I had to politely remind them that, hi, I want to thank you so much. I start off by ingratiating myself. Thank you for coming out to see my show. I would kindly like to remind you that on this cruise ship, which holds 4,000 people, there are many places you can have a conversation.
That's nice.
The place to have it is probably not surrounded by people who want to not hear your conversation. And so that got a little bit of applause and they quieted down. So sometimes you kind of have to be very...
Have you ever had to call security?
Me personally, no. I also have a very unique personality style on stage. I don't do anything confrontational.
I was going to say, you're not confrontational, so I wouldn't imagine that you get many hecklers, if at all.
No, the only time I ever get something that's vague like that, I was once performing at an adult dinner theater show.
Where they're drinking a lot.
Yeah, where they're drinking a lot. And somebody just thought it would be funny to say things like, $5 make you holla. Me love you long time while I'm performing.
Wow.
And then that's like, okay, I need to address this and then move on.
A little bit racist, you think?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you think? definitely would have said that to a white guy.
Oh, wow.
In those moments, I have to then take a moment to address that. This was the type of venue where I would literally, I think it was about $75 a ticket there. So I would walk out on stage with about $160 in my pocket because I knew that one night someone was going to say something and I would have to ask them to leave. So I was fully ready.
Back.
Yeah, I was like, hi, here's your money, but what did you pay? And you probably paid, a discounted ticket, because I've never seen someone pay full price and then respect so little what they were watching. But here's your money back. Goodbye. I never had to do it, but I always had it in my pocket in case.
That's interesting. I've got a question about not hecklers, but about selecting volunteers.
Mm.
I've had some conversations like with Kerry Pollack and some other people about this, who is really good at choosing volunteers. And that, I think, is one of the most difficult things to do for a magician who works on stage, to get the right person who is going to interact with you properly and not going to try to upstage you or too quiet or afraid or, you know what I'm saying? What do you do?
This is a really interesting thing because I know that I am not doing it right, but I'm doing it the way that lets me sleep at night.
Okay.
So if you scan, after you do this for long enough, you can scan the audience and find the perfect person. Oftentimes, the perfect person is not the person who wants to come up on stage. It's the person who is slightly hesitant because you know that they're going to be
I don't
supple.
Want someone who is, they're like a husband's pointing, take her.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't want to take her.
Definitely don't want to take her.
Right.
The guy who's pointing to someone else is oftentimes the best choice.
Yeah.
However, when you bring someone up on stage who doesn't want to be there, they are oftentimes very docile and will follow instructions and will give great reactions. However, they did not consent to coming up on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very important to pick people who agree to come up on stage.
Yes, because they want to be there.
They want to be there. Now, that being said, some people want to be there for all the wrong reasons.
Oh, boy.
I
had a stripper once who was, he kept trying to undress on stage. And I was saying, no, it's not that kind of show.
Yeah.
And so, she wanted to be there. It's like,
and
but
that's
for the wrong reason.
Exactly. So what I do is I only pick people who want to be there, and then I try to pick the best out of all that. And there have been many times where that has totally bit me. In the rear parts.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I would much rather pick someone who wants to be there and struggle with them than even once pick someone who didn't want to be there and embarrass them or do something that then they walk away with a bad taste in the mouth. Because then for the rest of their life, they're going to be talking about how, like, I really didn't want to be this one. I don't like magic shows. A magician picked me once and I didn't have a good time on stage. Even if you're a kind, polite person, they did not say yes. They did not give a resounding yes to coming up and being on stage. Whereas if someone said, yeah, pick me, and you bring them up, and then they are awful, whether it is intentional or unintentional, at least the audience is like, you know what? He did the best with what he had, and he's very polite about it.
And they're going to be on your side.
They will be on your side, exactly.
Yeah.
The instant you you are rude to someone, especially someone who didn't elect to be there, you lose a big percentage of the audience. And I think that there's that kind of kindness goes a long way with an audience.
I've told a story on the podcast before about where I once was working in an outdoor festival. This was in the late 1980s. So how far back this goes, when I was still learning how to go about selecting volunteers. And I had selected someone and I said, you know, come up and help me. She said, no. I said, really? No, you. And so give her some encouragement. And they applauded. She came up on stage, and it's like, it was the worst possible person. Okay, so the trick was this. It was an old Carol Fox trick in which that you have an invisible deck, supposedly, mm-hmm. and then written on your thumbnail would be, uh-huh. let's say, the QH for Queen of Hearts, mm-hmm. or something, right? And you say, do you see a card here?
The instant stooge.
Instant stooge, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so she nods, like, okay, I understand. And then I'm going to pull out this jumbo card, mm-hmm. you know, which is the Queen of Hearts. And so I said, so... did you see a card? She said, yes. And then I said, what was it? And she crossed her arms and she said, three of clubs. It's like, you know, okay, magic boy, you know, I didn't want to be here. And it's like, I could not take the position that, well, no, that's not the card you saw. You sure, right. Let's try it again, you know, or anything. I had to be the magician and come out of it. Mm-hmm. So I ended up improvising and doing like a card rise. I, mm-hmm. you know, found a card and did a card rise, and I got out of it and everything was fine because the audience doesn't know what's going to be happening at the end. And then she sat back down. But boy, did I learn a lesson. If somebody says no, don't bring them up. Yeah, no
even
means
if,
no.
Even
no
if
means
you
no.
think they're going to be perfect for a trick, you know, don't bring them up. You saw today, it's tough because, especially with a smaller audience, you don't have as many selections to pick from. I hit a balloon in the audience to select somebody. And if you're in a nice full house, mm-hmm. and people were there to see the magic,
sure,
lots of options. But, you know, people don't always know, because there's a lot of comedians who do crowd work, as we call it. Mm-hmm. And crowd work is just asking someone, like, you, sir, what do you do for a living?
What do you do? Where are you
and
from?
Then take building 10, 15 minutes off of people in the audience. And sure, sometimes it's kind, but most of the time it's not. Sure. And so I don't blame people for not wanting to sit in the front, for not wanting to participate. But, you know, it went out into the audience and then it landed on a guy who I knew was there as like a guest of the owners. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, you work nearby here? And he's like, yeah, I do. I was like, so you can help me out, but let me ask the audience, do you guys feel like he's a fair volunteer to pick? And a lot of people are like, no, pick someone else. So we hit the balloon to someone else and it went to someone who didn't want to be there. And I was like, do you want to help? And she's like, and then she relented and she was like, yeah, no,
she was great.
I'll do it. Yeah. And she wound up being perfect. But once again, I had to really be explicitly clear.
You handled
it
well.
Do you want to come up? You don't have to. Yeah. And once I made it clear that she doesn't have to, she was like, okay, if you're going to be polite about it, then yeah, this will be fine.
Yeah.
And half the time, all it takes is just like, you don't have to. It's fine. We can pick someone else. And when you do that, it takes the onus, it takes this pressure off of them. And most of the time they say yes.
But there is a thing also that if once you get a no, mm-hmm. you're going to start continuing to get no's.
Yeah.
So at some point you're going to have to say, sir, would you please come and join me? And I've heard this technique before, in which then you turn your back and you walk away. It's assuming that they're going to be coming up. And if they're not following, you said, yeah, I'm at you, sir, you know, or ma'am or whatever. But if you're saying, would you mind helping me? Mm-hmm. That's the same. If you ask a question where the potential answer could be no, you don't ask it that way. It's like, would you mind helping me? You said, please come and help me. That's a different way of saying it.
Yes, that is absolutely a different way of saying it. And there's this thing about how a lack of a no is not necessarily a yes. Mm. And also you want, you know, if you're going to have someone help you out, why not have it be a resounding yes? Anything short of a huge resounding yes is in some ways a no.
Mm-hmm.
Watching the way that you phrase things for the audience is very important, because I see a lot of entertainers like, are we having a good time so far? Like, what if people say no? I don't like it either, because first of all, have you not been hearing them applaud? If they've been applauding, then yes, they've been enjoying it.
That's right.
Don't try to weasel more applause out of an audience than you've
earned. I don't think that's that. I think it's just they're uncreative.
Yeah, that too.
And they just don't know what else to say, and they're trying to kill time.
It is a blank moment, and it is for a lot of entertainers, it's just, let me just get a little more yes.
A little more juice.
I want to feed my ego just a tiny bit more before I move on. But lots of times it is just laziness. Like, if you are a cruise director or an opening act, that's a little different, because you are trying to get a measure of the audience for the main act. But for lots of main acts, like asking, are we having a good time? Are you ready for a good show? Because what are they supposed to say? Like, no,
not really,
come back in
no.
20 minutes
exactly.
And then we'll see.
So speaking of when you had said earlier about when you had been in different plays, including Shakespeare and else others, did you sing in those? And talking, I wanted to ask a little bit about your singing part of them, because this is an aspect that you add to the magic with your music, which is beautiful. I know Paul Draper does a similar kind of
Paul
a thing.
Paul does a little bit of singing as well.
Yes.
My
friend Ben Jackson here in Houston actually plays the piano.
Oh, wonderful.
And it adds a lot.
We need more. You know what? So this was an extension of me just being who I am. And music plays a big part in my life. Singing plays a big part in my life. I'm constantly singing things. If you say a single phrase that reminds me of a song, I will then sing that line.
I heard you for like 10 minutes back in the dressing room just singing.
Yes, absolutely. 1,000,000%. That is me. And so I always tell people, like, be you on stage or create a version of the you that you're comfortable presenting on stage.
A bigger version of you.
Yeah, sometimes a bigger version, sometimes a smaller version, sometimes, you know, but it has to be, I think that authenticity is super important. And most people cannot fake authenticity. Unless you have a lot of acting training, I think that is very difficult to do. You were saying, talk about, the plays and stuff.
Yeah.
So the singing was part of any time I did a musical. Of course, I had to be able to sing. Sometimes I had my own number. Sometimes I was singing as part of a chorus, an ensemble.
But did you study singing, or you just kind of sang in the shower as a kid and liked it, or sang the chorus? And
I didn't start singing till I was a teenager. I did my first musical and I proved that I could sing well enough to be in the chorus. And then I said, I need to get better at this because I like doing this. So I actually kind of taught myself to sing by watching movies that featured singing, specifically Moulin Rouge, the Baz Luhrmann film with Ewan McGregor and Nicole Kidman. And I just sang along with Ewan McGregor till I could hit all the notes. And then after that, I started doing more and more musicals. And when you do musicals, they always have like a music director who's going to teach you the music. And lots of times they also know a lot about singing. So they will sometimes be able to give you tips about singing.
Okay.
So they'll be able to say, like, hey, sing this note again. Great. Can you do me a favor? Instead, and they'll like give you a little tip about it. So I've met lots of lovely people along the way who've helped me out and showed me the way, but I have no formal training when it comes to singing. And now that being said, I would not include this in my magic unless I felt it was as good as the magic, because a lot of people, when they hear it's like, oh, it's a comedy. You know, there's the trope about comedy magicians, which is that they're not funny enough to be full-time comedians. They're not good enough at magic to be full-time magicians. And therefore they do both kind of fine. And that is the trope about based on talking to just lay people. When they hear comedy magicians, some of them think, oh, it's just someone who's not great at both things. And all the comedy, and a lot of the comedy magicians I know are amazing at both things, especially someone like, you know, Harrison Greenbaum. There's all these hilarious, who are just as funny as any stand-up comedian you'll ever meet. But that's not always the case. Lots of people just like, well, I need something to make this different. So for me, because singing was such a big part of my life, I slowly started to phase it in. Of course, back in the day, it was just like all the magic. And I was like, well, I like getting laughs, so I'm going to add in the comedy. And then I hit this point where I realized I've spent years learning how to sing. I should really include this as part of it. And then the tough thing, of course, is finding the right balance. And I think it's the same thing with comedy magicians. Anytime you want to juggling with magic, any skills you want to intermix and mingle, you need to find the right balance. It can't feel shoehorned in. And so for me, finding the right balance between the magic and the singing is very important. So there'll be some routines where I don't sing. There'll be some routines where I don't even talk. But the routines where I think the balance works correctly, because one can't pull focus from the other. They have to only enhance each other. There's a few things like Dove. I sing something from The Greatest Showman while producing Tubbs, because I feel like the song moves well enough, and we've seen enough Dove acts that when we see this happen, it doesn't pull focus or nothing. Straight Jacket, I sing while escaping from a straight jacket, because everyone knows you start inside the straight jacket, you end out of the straight jacket. Very linear thing.
Yes.
And there's nothing inherently interesting unless you're telling jokes. There's nothing inherently interesting about it getting it, or you're dangling upside down over flaming spikes or something. You know, there's nothing inherently interesting.
Right.
There's danger, because we all have seen a straitjacket before. We know you're not going to step out on stage and escape out of a straitjacket if you don't know you can get out of it at the end.
Sure.
So add something to it to make it interesting to watch. That was the thing that I started adding. When did I officially add singing? I started kind of phasing it in around 2013, when I did America's Got Talent, I sang while getting out of a straitjacket. So that was kind of near the beginning of it.
Well, it's one of the things that Carissa Hendricks, as Lucy Darling, talks about, mm-hmm. the third surprise, where that she does comedy and she does magic. And if she feels like that they are expecting something to be funny, then she knows that, hey, I need to add fuel to this to give this a mysterious ending. And people kind of are twisting at the end, thinking, that was cool. That was a trick. Mm-hmm. And then the opposite way, if she's leading down the road and they think it's going to be a trick, then she does or says something that's funny and suddenly then it's comedy. So it's kind of like what you're saying, I guess, with music and magic and adding that so that you don't, that it's all part of your personality.
Yeah, I think it's very important that whatever you're doing is something that you're genuinely interested in. But also, so in the comedy writing world, the way it was explained to me back in the day, it was that it was called exploding expectations. Which is that, you know, like, and that is that twist. It's that thing where, like, you have the audience, their expectations are here, and you can find a way to mess with that, to explode it, to subvert it, to whatever it is. Because there's a story, there's always at least two stories happening. There's the story you're telling the audience,
right.
And there's the story they're telling themselves.
They're telling themselves, exactly right.
So there are, we talk about in theater and writing, we call it meta or meta-theatrics. And the meta-theatrics is outside of, like, the story. The story here is boy meets girl, falls in love, yada, yada. That is the story that is happening in the confines of the stage. Uh-huh. Then there's the meta-theatrics outside of that, which is that, oh, we've seen this kind of story before. There is the meta-theatrics of we are in this specific space with this specific lighting, with this specific sound. So let's say as this scene between a boy and a girl meeting is happening, the audio starts cutting in and out. Well, now this is a storyline that's happening outside of the primary storyline. This is a meta-theatrical storyline where now the audience is worried, like, what's going on with the sound? So now if they see a guy in black walk out to, like, deal with the sound issues, that's a secondary storyline. That's a meta-theatrical storyline. Uh-huh. Now, if something happens, if this guy who comes out to fix this has a heart attack, you know, like, these are all things, like, you can play with the storyline. Like, if you say you were going to find a playing card, a better example for this for magicians is, let's say you say you're going to find a playing card. They put it back inside the deck and you start shuffling the cards. I'm going to find the playing card. And they know you're playing with the playing cards a little bit more than usual. And you start looking through them. The meta-theatrics is, I think I think he's lost the playing card. And you can use that against them.
Yeah.
So,
kind of a magician in trouble, kind of a syndrome.
Exactly, yeah. Except it's less intentional, right? So there is something really interesting about this.
The almost subtleties.
Yeah, subtleties. And Bertolt Brecht was very famous for using this kind of like meta-theatrics, this outside, the story that's happening outside of what is being formally presented on stage. And just know that the audience is always writing their own story. And if you are smart enough to acknowledge that story and get ahead of it in some way, the audience will never see it coming because they only think, like, oh, this is what happens.
Beautiful. Wow. That is some great advice right there. Before I close, I do want to ask you about your brand, Teal. You're Mr. Teal.
Yes.
Magic with Teal. How did that come about? That just happened to be a color that you liked? I mean, that...
I can tell you exactly how it came about, as a matter of fact. Way back in the day, back when I was doing kids' birthday parties, I was one of the premier children's magicians in Orange County for a while, don't you know, dear boy? I think psychology and brand recognition, all this stuff plays an important part into the business that we play, that we run, right? Like there are things that are associated with specific magicians, White Tigers with Siegfried and Roy, Vanishing the Statue of Liberty with David Copperfield. There are things that are important to the recognition. Because I was performing a lot of kids' birthday parties, I wanted something to anchor me in, a commonality that you'd be able to see me at a show. It's like, oh, we saw this guy. He's the guy who does this thing or wears this thing or has this thing.
Uh-huh.
Brand recognition. And so for a while, I would wear like this red striped bow tie, a self tie, of course. A real
so it's
kind of
like Billy, Silly Billy. Has
Silly Billy, yeah, exactly. Or, you know, there's lots of Paul Green or Jason Latimer, you know, like they have these through lines with the colors. And so I would wear this fedora with a little bit of red in the hat band, and then I'd do tricks with red sponge balls, and I have the red bow tie. And I wanted, like, okay, let's have the red kind of be the anchor color. And then one day I was thinking about it, and I said, from a psychological standpoint, red's a terrible color. Red's a color of stop, danger, poison.
Oh.
It's a power color.
It is a power color.
It's very
That's
aggressive.
All I thought of.
Uh-huh. It's an aggressive color.
Okay.
And so I said, I don't really love it. If you wear too much red, it's very wearing on the eyes. You know, it's a fire stations, you know, that sort of thing. And so I said, all right, well, let's play around this. And one day I was walking through a Ross Dress for Less, and its color caught my eye. And it was this lovely teal dress shirt. And I said, that's great, because blue is much more relaxing. They use blue and seafoam in hospitals. But it's this, like, teal, which is, like, halfway between blue and green. So it's very bright. It catches your eye. It's fun. It works great in the summer. It works great in the winter. It's kind of...
And you're not going to blend into a black or dark background.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very important thing. You know, you walk out in a black suit against a black backdrop.
You're a floating head.
Yeah, guess what? You know, so, which is why I love people who wear, you know, if you want something that looks super formal, but still stands out against the background, it's a great thing to wear navy or charcoal, you know, because it still looks very dark and formal, but you don't disappear into a background. So... I bought this teal dress shirt, and it's weird. All the times I've been wearing red, no one once ever said to me, red looks so good on you. Or like, oh my God, I love that color. What, as soon as I started wearing teal, people were like, oh my God, people would say, that's my favorite color. They would say, wow, I love that color. Or they say, that's a great color on you. Mm-hmm. Which is even better because it means that it somehow plays well with your skin tone or whatever to your personality. It calls them. And so I immediately started getting compliments on how great a color it was. And I said, great. I went back to that Ross. I bought all those dress shirts in that size. And then as I got older, I started ordering custom shirts anytime somebody had something teal. And then it became this fun game of like, anytime I can find a prop in teal, I have a teal ukulele. I have a teal case. I have all these things. It just is now this.
And
like,
you throw up a
confetti, heel. The shoelaces, the braces, right, or suspenders, everything is teal. And now it just shows an additional layer of thought because it means that you know who you are, you know what you like, and I'm going to carry this through everything that I do on stage.
Well, I was thinking about that. That's why I wore this teal.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I noticed this nice kind of like this lovely.
I'd like what you said also regarding the cutting up of the confetti. Mm. We're going to start to wrap up here with this. And that is how that, explain that about, and that's so lovely to the audience.
So for anyone who's never seen me perform, the bit that I do before I close the show is I talk about how much I appreciate the audience. And depending on how much time I have, it's a longer speech, shorter speech. But I talk about how I'm, one of my heroes in magic is Howard Thurston, and he used to do this thing where he'd peek out through the curtain as the audience was coming in, and he would whisper to them before he walked on stage under his breath, "I love you, I love you, I love you." Mm-hmm. That he could walk out filled with gratitude and appreciation. I feel like so many times, because we do so many shows, sometimes some of us do a lot of shows, some of us don't do a lot of shows. But those of us who do a lot of shows, we start to get a bit jaded because we start to compare this audience to every other audience we've ever had, and we want them to be as good as the best audience we've ever had,
of course.
Whether or not we are at that same level, or they are at that same level, or it makes sense to be at that level, we want that from them. There's nothing wrong with wanting the best reactions possible. But it is sometimes unfair to compare that audience to the best audience you've ever had, especially when best audience you ever had was, you know, thousands of people on a cruise ship, and this audience is 20-something people in Houston. And this audience was absolutely lovely. I'm not by any means saying that they weren't lovely. But it's unfair to make these comparisons. And so to zero yourself, to just walk into this with appreciation, with this thought of that, listen, they are here. They bought tickets. They're here to see you.
That's right.
And you've worked your whole life for this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate that. And so I talk about Howard Thurston, and I talk about how my way of showing my appreciation for my audience is this confetti. And I, through the whole show, I'm throwing this teal confetti, which seems like this kind of a dumb bit, slightly like a hack bit. But what makes this special is to tell the audience that this is hand-cut confetti. Every single piece was cut by hand from a larger sheet. And so that just that little extra step helps them appreciate that I appreciate them. And it's
that you go to that extra 20 minutes to do that.
It does. It doesn't actually take 20 minutes, but the core of it is true. I do genuinely, I had to search through so many brands of tissue paper to find this color that matches what I have. And then I do sit down and I do cut every piece and I put it in a little teal
jar.
Just
watch TV or something.
It's a really nice thing before each show to kind of zero myself.
Which, by the way, I really love your nerdiness. You know,
yes, we were chatting about Mandalorian and
Star Wars and everything.
And Quantum Leap. And yeah. Yes, I'm a huge, as you could tell from one of my pieces tonight, a huge fan of sci-fi.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
a whole different conversation.
It is. That's the sci-fi
different
podcast.
Podcast.
The sci-fi word.
Here we go.
you know, the audience, I don't know when this happened, but at a certain point, magicians, lots of entertainers think that aloofness is cool. You know, Copperfield has a little bit of a distance. There's a, there's a mystique around Copperfield, around a lot of performers. And I'm not that kind of guy.
No.
I am...
You're a magician of the people.
I'm a magician of the people. I am gregarious. I am friendly. And
I like the way you say it in Scottish. Say it again.
Gregarious.
Gregarious.
Yes, I'm, as I've mentioned before, I'm dangerously... Oh, excuse me. Oh, that's Scotch. Scotch is catching up with me. I'm dangerously gregarious. Because I do this a bit for me, but I mostly do it for them. And there is something about knowing that they love you and they appreciate you. So why not show them that you appreciate them in whatever manner that is? You don't have to cut your own confetti, but you know, take a moment. I think that before your finale, you should take a moment to thank your audience truly, genuinely.
Yep.
And, I will let you know now that it is not uncommon for me to cry on stage when I'm thanking the audience. Because think about all the things you could be doing in life.
Oh my goodness.
Think about, and I have to tell myself, like, my best day crunching numbers in an office has got to be much worse than my worst day on any stage.
Well, well said. I can appreciate that.
So let your audience know that. You are not Copperfield. You are not, if you are a naturally aloof person, you can find a way to play into that. I am not. I want them to know how much this means to me because I am a neurotic, anxious mess most of the time. But as soon as I step out on that stage...
You're dangerously gregarious.
I'm dangerously gregarious. No, I'm all those anxieties and worries
disappear. I think that's the title of this podcast.
Yeah, dangerously gregarious. Do that.
I like that a lot. As we do wrap up, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. I always like to ask as my last question, what is it that's your philosophy of life?
Enjoy.
Doesn't have to be a word. It could be a whole phrase. I mean, it's something.
Whole phrase.
Yeah. What is it that you, when you wake up in the morning, that gets you going and keeps you going throughout the day?
There's a line from I've Got to Be Me, made famous by Sammy Davis Jr. And the line is, I want to live, not merely survive. It's such a good line. You got to live. You can't just survive. We work too hard to just survive. You got to live.
That's why that my word is always, what is life if you can't live it?
Yeah, exactly. If you're not dreaming, then you're just sleeping.
There you go. Nathan, thanks very much. It's been a wonderful hour here.
Yes, absolutely.
I've enjoyed it. I'm glad we finally got a chance to catch up because I know that you are always going every place. And I'm just glad when I see you on TV, I said, oh, it's my buddy.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to seeing you the next time, wherever that might be down the road. And hopefully we get to share another glass of scotch.
Absolutely. Glass of scotch. And I don't know when this releases, but depending on when it releases, you might still be able to catch season 10 of Masters of Illusion on the CW Network Monday nights at 9 p.m.
There you go. And if not, he'll probably be on season 11 too.
Hopefully. He's
been and also on the tour.
Yes.
As well. Who knows? It might be able to catch him in a place near you.
And if you see
Liberty
me.
Liberty Theater or wherever.
Liberty Theater, wherever you see me, if you do see me, if you mentioned that you heard me on Scott Wells' podcast, it means a lot. So.
It means a lot to me then as well. So, and to find out more about where he's going to be going, go to
MagicAsianMan.com.
There you go. And that's the way you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook and everything else as well. Please do. He's a great guy. You'll enjoy the tweets and everything he puts out. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Nathan Fan. And I am a Nathan member of the Nathan Fan Society.
Nathan Fan Club.
Nathan Fan Club.
Your t-shirt right here. It's proof. Right.
This is Scotty out. Thank you, Nathan. That was just a ball of fun. I enjoyed getting a chance to chat with you. You really are just a ball of energy. And I hope that you keep doing what you're doing. You have a lot of good advice that you gave us here this week, and I'm sure the listeners will appreciate that too. And also, as he had mentioned, if you happen to see Nathan out on tour, be sure to tell him, hey, I enjoyed listening to you on the Magic Word Podcast. It kind of is some pretty good feedback that he and I both would appreciate. And also, I want to remind everybody to be sure to go to this week's blog where you can fill out a form. Actually, there's not much to it. You just put in your name and email and then hit enter now in order to have a chance to win one of two prizes that'll be given away, the Side Roller, which is the new trick by Michael Breger. And if you live within the U.S., domestic postage is free. So I know that you will enjoy it, but you have to enter to win. You will always miss every shot that you don't take. So why not take all the shots you can? Who knows? So we appreciate you coming back and listening every week. And make sure that if you haven't subscribe to the Pod Letter, be sure you do that. And also be sure and tell your friends about this. And if you have the financial ability to assist us, then we would appreciate you becoming a patron of the Magic Word Podcast. Just go to patreon.com/themagicword and you can help us there. And that will help our podcast to continue on the air. This is going to be a lot of fun. Next week, we're going to be heading out to Los Angeles, where we're going to be going to the Collector's Magic Expo. And then I'm going to hang around the Magic Castle for a while and have a chance to visit with a few people who hopefully I will get to record, and we'll be posting those in future weeks. And then, of course, I'm going to hang out at the Magic Castle and go to the awards banquet on May the 17th when I'll be receiving the Special Fellowship Award. And I just can't thank the Academy enough for that, and also all of you listeners for making this podcast what it is. I really do appreciate that from my heart. Thank you. Thank you very much for listening and for all the positive vibes you send us, and also the financial support, all the cards and emails, texts and whatnot. Anyhow, enough of that. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And be sure to come back again next week. We got some more good stuff coming your way. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember that you've got to live, not merely survive. This is Scotty out.